Hi, I'm Bill Kroll with the Albemarle Pamlico National Estuary Program. Welcome back to Estuary Live. We're going to talk about something estuary in a big way, and that's weather. With me here is Bob Frederick with the National Weather Service and Hunter and Megan from Halifax Academy here in North Carolina. So Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about the weather and estuary, and I think you have a few slides and things to talk about to start us off with.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. I want to thank Amy and everybody from Estuary Live for letting NOAA's National Weather Service come down here and give a brief talk about the weather. I've been in the Weather Service since 1990, and I've been stationed at the office up in Newport since 1994 when it opened. I'm going to talk today about tides and water levels, and also about the Gulf Stream and how it can impact the weather along the coast here. Let's start out with tides. Basically, tides are the result of gravitation from the moon. The moon is pulling on the Earth, and the Earth's gravitation holds the moon in place. If we think of the Earth as a round sphere covered in water, and if we look at figure one, we can show this. The gravitation from the moon sort of makes a bulge on the Earth, and as the Earth rotates, the Earth sort of rotates through that bulge, and that is the high tide. And as it rotates through the minimum, that's the low tide. So the Earth rotates 24 hours. We normally have about four tide cycles. It's slightly greater. It's about 12 hours and 24 minutes, roughly, between each high tide and each low tide. And that's because not only is the Earth rotating, but the moon's orbit as well. We can see on the pier over here, the tidal range here in Beaufort is about 3 to 4 feet. We're approaching low tide right now. The water, I don't know if you can see it on the camera, but there's a current that's heading out towards the inlet, and that's as the water is leaving. So it's probably not going to drop too much further. And on the poles there, you can see the water line up higher, and that's where it would normally be during high tide. The shape of the coast has a lot to do with the size of the tide. Figure two sort of shows the tidal range here in Beaufort for a couple day period, and normally it stays within about 3 to 4 feet. Some parts of the world have much bigger tides, depending on the depth of the water and the shape of the coast. Up in eastern Canada, there's a place called Bay of Fundy, and they have a 40-foot change between the low tide and the high tide. So you can imagine what kind of currents and things they have there when the waters come in and go out that fast. Here in Beaufort, like I said, it's about 3 to 4 feet, but it varies from day to day, week to week, depending on how the sun and the moon and the Earth are all aligned. If we go back to figure one, the graphic shows that when the sun and the moon are lined up, that gravitation from both of them pulls a little bit more, and that creates what we call a spring tide. It doesn't necessarily occur in the spring, but it's just called a spring tide, meaning it's one of the higher tides of the year. Typically here along the North Carolina coast, those high tides would generally be about 1 foot higher than the normal high tide. And at the same time as being a real high tide, the low tide that day would also be real low, so there's a big variation. When the sun and the moon are not aligned, when they're 90 degree angles, we call those neap tides. They're the smaller tides of the month. They typically occur when the moon is at 1/4 or 3/4 full. And we might only have a 2 or 3 foot tidal variance when we have that. Let me talk a little bit about some weather conditions that can sort of affect the tide or the water levels along the coast. The biggest one by far is winds. If we have strong onshore winds, I mean when winds blow from water towards land, that kind of makes the tides or water levels higher. The wind pushes on the water and sort of counteracts the gravity that naturally wants to take it back out into the ocean. And we can get higher than normal water levels. It's just the opposite if the wind's blowing offshore from land to water. That kind of pushes the water offshore quicker, and you can get real low tides. And that's important for not only flooding, but for navigation. People in ships or boats that don't have a lot of clearance need to know how much water is going to be at a specific point so they can get in and out safely. Probably the most common thing people think of when they think of high tides with winds is hurricanes. We call it the storm surge with a hurricane is whenever the right front of the hurricane moves on shore, the strongest winds are right there, you know, 70, 80, up to 150 miles an hour. And as that hurricane moves on shore, those strong winds push the water up along the coast and create flooding and all sorts of problems. I have figure three, I believe, of Isabel. It shows a graphic of the storm surge we got from that hurricane a couple years ago when it made landfall just north of here, up near Drum Inlet. And you can see in the graphic there was about a 6 to 8 foot surge on the Outer Banks. That was a Category 2 hurricane. 6 to 8 feet here would be probably getting close. At high tide, it would be up over this pier, and low tide would be about equal to the pier. Isabel did quite a bit of damage. I think the next figure four, shows just a truck that was flipped over by that storm surge. Fortunately, Hurricane Isabel was well forecast, and we had a warning out in plenty of time, so most of the people evacuated the Outer Banks, and there was no fatalities from Hurricane Isabel. And that's important. Whenever a hurricane warning is issued or hurricanes approaching the coast, it's critical that people in low-lying areas and close to the beach evacuate as they're told. A Category 4 to a Category 5 hurricane produces a 15 to 20 foot storm surge. So you can imagine that would be over my head and probably up halfway up on some of these buildings, and many, many areas and homes around here would be severely flooded, and nobody would want to stay here if we have a hurricane of that magnitude striking this area. Besides hurricanes, we got nor'easters. Nor'easters aren't typically quite as strong as hurricanes, but they're bigger. Usually they cover a much bigger area, and sometimes they move rather slowly. And you can get persistent, strong winds from the same direction. And the flooding might not be as instantaneous or as fast as a hurricane, but it can be almost as damaging. Water levels can rise 6 to 8 feet above normal and stay that way through successive tide cycles and do a lot of damage. And there's been some fairly famous nor'easters that have impacted not only North Carolina, but the entire East Coast. There was the Ash Wednesday storm in 1962 that persisted off the coast for several days and produced massive coastal flooding all the ways up and down the East Coast of the United States. The Perfect Storm was another famous nor'easter. The movie was made about it, where the commercial fishing boat unfortunately sunk and some people lost their lives. But that was also a unique situation where a tropical system merged with a normal low pressure system we get in the winter and sat off of the New England coast for a while. And even down here in North Carolina, we were getting big 10 to 20 foot waves that produced coastal flooding. Okay, I'm going to talk about something that's not purely weather related, but that can certainly impact water levels and if they happen, and that's a tsunami. Tsunamis, sometimes referred to as tidal waves in the United States, but the correct word is tsunami, which is a Japanese word for a harbor wave, are massive waves that occur typically when earthquakes happen near or offshore in the ocean. We all remember, unfortunately, back around Christmas time, there was the huge tsunami that occurred over the Indian Ocean, where about a 30 to 40 foot successive waves came ashore and did tremendous damage and loss of life. Over 200,000 people, I believe, were killed in that tsunami. Basically, there's about three things, main things that cause tsunamis. By far the most common are earthquakes. As the earthquake happens, it usually shifts the earth. Sometimes the earth shifts horizontally. Those don't typically produce tsunamis. But the one over the Indian Ocean this past winter shifted vertically, where the seafloor actually lifted about 30 feet off the bottom of the seafloor, and that displaced the water, and that created a wave. And over the open ocean, tsunamis can move at tremendous speeds, sometimes 500, 600 miles an hour. They're not very big in the open ocean. They might only be 3 foot high, but they're hundreds of miles long. And as they approach the coast, they slow down because of friction as they get in shallower water, and they build up. And that's how they get such big size, big size to them. I believe I have figure five shows a before and after over near the Indian Ocean. The before picture shows the water actually being drawn out. As the tsunami approaches, as it starts building up, it actually sucks water from the beach out further out into the ocean. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't realize what was going on, and they went down to the beach to see what was going on. And the second picture shows the actual tsunami rushing ashore. And these pictures were taken by satellite, and it's only a few minutes before and after, but that water instantly came back in and unfortunately did a lot of damage.
We've had a couple of questions come in. And the first one is, do you think North Carolina will ever have a tsunami?
You can't rule it out. 95% of the earthquakes that produce tsunamis occur in the Pacific Basin. However, there are known fault lines in the Atlantic Ocean, especially in the Caribbean Sea area, and they can produce tsunamis that would impact North Carolina. Recently, the NOAA has just expanded, is in the process of expanding its tsunami warning network. They have a system of buoys that are right now in the Pacific Ocean that detect, basically what happens is they detect, the USGS detects an earthquake and they pinpoint where it is, and then they watch these buoys to see if there's a sign of a tsunami. They have under things anchored to the floor that can sense the pressure. They also have a buoy that sits on top of the ocean that can detect a wave. They're going to expand this to the Atlantic Basin. I believe they're going to put 7 buoys in the Atlantic Ocean that can help detect tsunamis.
If a tsunami ever hit North Carolina, how far inland would that water affect us?
It depends on the size of the tsunami. From an earthquake, it's estimated the largest tsunami would be close to what they had over the Indian Ocean. And that could probably, that was about a 30 or 40 foot at its max surge, that might be able to go in inland about a mile or so, but that's probably an extreme case. Two other things can create tsunamis. One is a landslide, either above ground that falls into the ocean, or one that happens underneath the seafloor where the sand shifts. Those also can produce tsunamis, but typically around here we don't think they would be quite that big. One last thing that creates tsunamis would be a meteor striking the ocean. And there's no telling how big, if a big enough meteor were to strike, that could produce a tsunami of unimaginable size just about anywhere. So it can happen, and that's one of the reasons why NOAA is expanding the tsunami network to try to detect them before they hit.
Can aquatic life survive during a tsunami?
Yes, in the open ocean, the tsunami really won't do too much. Right along the beach, it's probably going to disrupt a lot of the marine life, especially anything that's tied to the seafloor, because that onrushing water, it slows down when it hits the beach, but it's still moving at probably 30 miles an hour, so that could pick up and carry most anything away. So yeah, it disrupts stuff close to the beach or on the beach, but out in the open ocean, I don't think they'd probably notice it that much. Any more questions? Okay. I think I have one more slide with tsunamis. I believe it's slide 5 or 6. It shows the slide 6 shows a before and after of what happened over in the Indian Ocean. Just the amount of devastation that happened. You can see where almost entire island and beach was just completely destroyed. All the trees, all the man-made houses were gone. So tsunamis can do a tremendous amount of damage, and that's proof of it. One last thing I want to talk about that could could affect water levels in the future is global warming. We're not sure exactly what extent global warming is going to play, but the signs are there that we are beginning to experience global warming. And global warming is basically the increase in what we call greenhouse gases. When we burn things like fossil fuels, like coal, oil, or natural gas, the emissions from those go into the upper atmosphere, and it sort of acts like a greenhouse where it lets the sun energy through, but then when the sun hits the earth and warms up, the energy that goes back is not allowed to escape back into outer space. It basically is trapped within the earth's atmosphere, and it gradually leads to a warmer and warmer climate. And the result of that is, as the temperatures rise, the thought is that we're slowly going to have melting of the polar ice shields, ice caps, glaciers, and such like that. And as they melt, they drain into the ocean, and it's possible we could gradually see the oceans rise. Like I said before, nobody knows for sure exactly to what extent. They run big computer models that sort of project, based on what they feed into them, what might happen to water levels, and it's estimated in the next 100 years, water levels could rise 2 to 3 feet. And it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but many homes or businesses and things could be impacted by that kind of water level rise. So it's something that we don't know for sure, but it's something we need to think about that could begin to impact not only man-made structures, but also natural things like estuaries. If we get a 3-foot water rise, that could completely change an estuary where the water typically is shallow. All of a sudden, it could be 3 feet, and that could change the type of marine life that would live in that type of environment. So global warming is something we're going to watch in 50 to 100 years. Isn't really that long. A lot of students out there are watching this. Probably in their lifetimes, we'll see some of these temperatures rise and maybe see the ocean start to rise as well.
I think it's interesting to talk about the sea level rise. North Carolina is pretty low for most of our eastern portion in the coastal plain, and I always try to visualize what the sea level rise would mean. And you mentioned down here we have the piers on the dock, and that here's a 3-foot tidal range here. So then what we're talking about is, so the sea level, you know, in people's mind, the water comes up from this point, comes about 2 feet up, that comes up about near high tide, but then we're talking about another 2 to 3 feet above that during the next high tide. So we're talking about the seawall here, and it's an impact that you might not recognize when you're standing on the beach, but as you move into towns where there are bulkheads and docks and people's homes, then you start to see where that water level would be. We had a couple of tsunami questions. We'll try to answer those real quick. Lori? Actually, I can't read them, but we'll come back to those now. There we go. Jeff wants to know where the next tsunami will occur, and I think we said we really don't know. That's dependent on earth actions, earthquakes, and landslides and such. But then Casey at Bregal Middle School wanted to know how wind would affect a tsunami wave.
Because of the large size of a tsunami and the speed that they move, I don't think wind would really have any impact. If the wind was blowing onshore, it wouldn't really increase the size of it. And if it was blowing offshore, I don't think it would make it any smaller. The tsunami has got its own energy built into it. It's moving, like I said, with such force that when it starts moving onshore, the wind really would not impact it much at all, I don't believe.
Good question for you. Mm-hmm. On the subject of global warming, would it ever be possible for the barrier islands to be completely covered by water?
I guess it's possible, yes. If some of these computer models are right and we do see the ocean rise 3 feet, many places that are now above ground would already be flooded. And that's just the next 100 years. Some of the projections out beyond that show we could have as much as a 6 or 7 foot rise. So that could really impact barrier islands and coastal areas. Global warming is sort of it's a tough subject because we don't know for sure. We wish we could say, yes, it's happening, and yes, the ocean is going to rise, but we really can't at this point. But it's something that we're monitoring. The Earth has been warmer the last couple of years than it's been before recorded. And I just read recently where some of the melting of the glaciers in the North Pole are greater this year than they've been. So that could be the signs that's beginning to happen. But sort of what we're guessing at, sea level rises and things like that, are just estimates at this point. We really don't know for sure. But I believe it could impact Barrier Island significantly down the road, definitely. Okay, well, the next question is, will all the water on Earth eventually evaporate? Basically, there's a water cycle. As water evaporates, it's lifted up into the air, and it condensates out in clouds and eventually falls back down as precip eventually. So it's sort of a natural cycle. So even as the Earth warms, it's believed that there'll probably be an increase in rainfall or precipitation, and that would really not, the water wouldn't evaporate. It might rain more or less in certain areas, but the amount of water would probably stay the same. Okay, the next question is, if water is going to rise over the years, will it eventually take over the Earth? It's not going to rise that much. It definitely could impact coastal regions and low-lying areas near the coast, but you know, it could only rise so much. There's only so much ice that can melt up in the polar regions, and even if you melt all of that, it could only make the Earth rise so many feet. So we don't have to worry about it flooding the whole Earth. And another question from Mrs. Haynes' class is, how can we prepare for a tsunami? The best preparation is just to have a plan of action. We now have a tsunami warning network for the United States. The best thing to do is to think of a plan of action, what you would do if we ever have a tsunami warning. Think about where you can go, what you can do. You want to get to higher ground. You don't want to stay near the water. One thing I think, you know, we would like to have warnings out for all tsunamis, but if you're ever at the beach and you see the water start going out, like an extremely low tide, all of a sudden, sort of what happened over in the Indian Ocean, head for higher ground instantly. Don't sit around and wait, because that's usually a sign that there's a large wave getting ready to come ashore.
One of the things you mentioned that rung a bell in my head was the talk about a cycle for the water. And one of the things that a lot of our students are studying out there is the water cycle. And I know that y'all have been studying that as well. I was wondering if you could just kind of run through it, let's say starting at rain.
The rain falls as precipitation, and then it evaporates up into the atmosphere, and then it condenses again and then falls as precipitation again.
And that's kind of the basic of our weather. I know that the oceans are a big driving force for our global weather patterns. And right off North Carolina, we have the Gulf Stream and the Labrador Current mixing. One's a very warm water current moving to the north in a clockwise position in the Atlantic Ocean. And then the Labrador is moving down a counterclockwise down the east coast of the United States. How does that affect the weather patterns here in North Carolina?
Thank you. That's a great lead into my next section, which is the Gulf Stream. Gulf Stream can impact weather in many areas. Let me first sort of go over how the Gulf Stream gets its start. The Gulf Stream basically starts in the equatorial region, down in the Atlantic Ocean, down by the equator. We tend to get constant, what we call trade winds, or winds that blow from east to west, and that constant wind creates an equatorial current. That current moves west and hits South America, and much of it is deflected north into the Gulf of Mexico. It then moves clockwise around the Gulf of Mexico and then northeast along the east coast of the United States. I believe the next figure, I think it's figure 7, shows a pretty broad picture of the Gulf Stream. You can see clearly this is an infrared satellite picture, and infrared pictures measure the temperature of things on Earth, and the warm Gulf Stream shows up as a red color, and the colder areas show up as blue, the colder water. The Labrador Current up by Cape Hatteras is blue, and the warm Gulf Stream is red. After the Gulf Stream goes off Cape Hatteras, it heads into the North Atlantic and can completely modify the weather over in Europe. Where Europe is located, you normally would expect them to have very cold weather, but because the Gulf Stream current goes up in that part of the world and the winds blow across the Gulf Stream, they have a much warmer climate than they normally would expect. We're here in North Carolina, the Gulf Stream affects temperatures for one. Most of the time the wind's blowing offshore from west to east around here, but occasionally it does blow from southeast or south. When it does that, it tends to blow across the Gulf Stream, and that can bring warm air to the coastal areas, and sometimes it can spread even into the central part of the state. It also can produce fog. When the air blows over the Gulf Stream, it moistens up because the Gulf Stream is warm and humid. And as that air cools over the cooler nearshore waters, or if it moves on land, it condenses down to the dew point. And sometimes we can get widespread sea fog that can affect boat navigation and even motorists over land. Okay, we have a question here. What is the largest period of time an area could survive without rain? That's a good question. I guess it depends on what you mean, what could survive. Some parts of the desert southwest United States don't get rain for 2 or 3 years at a time, and there really isn't much that lives there. Most every form of life needs some sort of water. Some plants and animals are designed to go without it for a long period of time, but I don't think anything can go without water for forever. Everything needs a little bit of water. And their next question is, are there factors that affect the speed of the water cycle? Probably if it's warmer, the water cycle would tend to be faster. You would get more evaporation, and more evaporation as more water or water vapor in the air, and that can be condensed into clouds and rain. So a warmer, more humid climate would speed up the cycle compared to cooler, drier climate. Okay.
I know some of the other factors that affect our water cycle also includes what season it is. In the winter we have not as much plant growth, so there's less transpiration occurring. So the water cycle is a little different through the seasons. I was wondering if y'all have any questions about our local weather, like what's happening today or anything like that?
Well, mainly, like this wind, how would this affect the life today that's out on the shores? What would this...
A wind like this really wouldn't have too much impact. It's not strong enough to really create any problems. Later this week, we're going to have a low-pressure system move up along the Gulf Stream. And that's another way the Gulf Stream affects the weather, is that warm, moist air associated with the Gulf Stream is favorable for storms to develop. And as this low pressure comes up the Gulf Stream, it's going to strengthen a bit. And the pressure gradient between this coming low and the high pressure to our north is going to create a tight pressure gradient. And that produces strong northeast winds. So later this week, probably starting tomorrow and Friday into Saturday, we're going to have much stronger winds than this, probably 20 to 30 with maybe gusts of 40 miles an hour. That'll impact some areas of the coast. Here, a northeast wind for much of Carteret County is actually an offshore wind. Our beaches are such that a northeast wind is offshore, so the water levels don't really rise. But on the northern Outer Banks and the southern Pamlico Sound, which is not too far from here, a northeast wind does create higher than normal water levels. We can get beach erosion and coastal flooding. So that's something we're definitely going to have to watch.
Talking about winds and tides, in Currituck Sound to the north of here, and somewhat up in Albemarle Sound, people have what they call wind tides. And I was just wondering if you could explain what that means.
I assume they're talking about maybe like the sea breeze type effect, where during the day along the coast, the inland areas or land-based areas warm up. And as they warm, the air rises, and that draws the air from the ocean to replace it. And we call that the sea breeze. And we typically get that in the afternoon, usually when the temperatures reach a certain point versus the water, where a sea breeze develops. Here in Carteret County, it's usually a south or southwest wind. Other parts of the coast, it can be an east or southeast wind, but typically that's what we call the sea breeze.
We've had a few more questions come in, and Mason and Luke want to know, can the Gulf Stream ever cover more area than it does today?
Yes, that's a good question, and if we go to my next figure, I believe it's figure 8 which is a close-up of the Gulf Stream from North Carolina, you can see that, you know, the western wall of the Gulf Stream is clearly defined, but there's also little pockets off the Gulf Stream. We call them eddies, that are little warm eddies that break off of the Gulf Stream, and sometimes these come towards shore, and we can have a warm pocket of air move right into the beach area, especially along the Outer Banks. You can also get cold eddies from the Labrador Current that mix in with the Gulf Stream. So the Gulf Stream is sort of a, you can almost think of it like a river. It's usually in a certain spot, but it can vary in its exact location, and it also can sometimes broaden out and tighten up. So it's not really always in the same spot. One interesting thing about the Gulf Stream is its massive size. 70 off the coast of North Carolina, I believe it's 70 million cubic meters of water per second flow through the Gulf Stream. That's 30 times bigger than all the rivers on Earth put together. So that's how much water is flowing north from the Gulf Stream. Next question is, what is the average temperature in the Gulf Stream? It varies. This time of the year, the core of the Gulf Stream is probably around 75 to 80 degrees. In the dead of winter, it stays above 70, it probably in the low 70s in the middle of winter off North Carolina. And in the middle of summer, it can get as high as the mid to upper 80s. So it's a very warm stream of water. And that warm water, one other weather impact from the Gulf Stream is hurricanes. Hurricanes need 80 degree water or warmer to survive or develop or intensify. And the Gulf Stream usually has that warm water out there, especially in the summer months. So hurricanes like last year, we had Hurricane Alex that formed to our south in the Gulf Stream and moved up along the coast and really impacted the Outer Banks. And that the main reason it formed was because of the warm temperatures of the Gulf Stream. And I believe slide 9 shows a little bit of flood damage from Hurricane Alex. And slide 10 also shows how the Gulf Stream can impact a hurricane. Slide 10 shows the path of Hurricane Hugo. Hurricane Hugo was a very strong hurricane that came ashore in South Carolina, I believe in 1989. And it was a strong hurricane to begin with, but right when it hit the Gulf Stream, as you can see on the graphic, the color scale shows the intensity. It became a Category 4 when it came over the Gulf Stream right before it made landfall in South Carolina. So the Gulf Stream can not only help develop a hurricane, but can also make one intensify. Okay, we got another question here. Will there be a perfect storm? There can always be, the definition of a perfect storm is sort of vague, but the perfect storm that the movie was about was the interaction between a tropical low pressure system and a non-tropical low that sort of merged up in the North Atlantic. There can be storms. We have a storm called the Superstorm that impacted the eastern part of the United States in March of 1993. It actually was stronger than the perfect storm. It had pressure is equivalent to a pretty strong hurricane as it moved up along the coast. So the ingredients have to be perfect for there to be that kind of low pressure, but there probably will be additional low pressures as strong as what that storm was. Got another question is, how do rainbows form? And rainbows form when the sunlight, it hits the rain that's falling. And the sun angle has to be just right. If the sun is directly overhead, like around noontime, you won't ever get a rainbow. But if the sun sun is at a pretty sharp angle in the morning or evening, and it falls through raindrops, sort of like what we're getting right now, except the sun's too high, you can get a rainbow when the sun is low in the sky. So it depends on the sun angle, and there has to be some precipitation or rain falling. I guess that's, anybody else have any questions?
I think that's it.
Well, we appreciate you coming out here. We would like to know why you became a meteorologist, and what type of studying that you had to do that, and you know what really is your interest in weather? Why do you do what you do?
Okay, I became a meteorologist basically because I always liked the weather. As a kid, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and I used to just get real excited when there was a snowstorm or a thunderstorm or something like that. So I just always had an interest in it, and when I graduated from high school, I first started in computer science and found out I wasn't very good at that. And I decided to go to something I really liked, and decided to major in meteorology. To become a meteorologist, you would want to focus on math science courses, because there's a lot of math and science in meteorology. And there's also quite a bit of communication skills. You've got to be able to write. We write products all the time at the Weather Service when we issue forecasts or warnings, so you have to have writing skills and communication skills. And there's a question of where can teachers get satellite pictures. I don't have, well, you can go to weather.gov, which is the National Weather Service, sort of a broad-based website, and on there you'll have links to local weather offices, such as the one here in Eastern North Carolina in Newport, or just about anywhere in the country. And off of those home pages, you usually have, we have links for satellite pictures. So you can go to any National Weather Service homepage and get a link from there to a satellite picture.
You can also visit the NOAA website at NOAA.gov and type in through their search. You can type in satellite images, or Landsat is another one you could do. Or if you're looking for particular for a storm image or something like that, type in Hugo or Isabel, something like that. That's another resource for you. So are either one of you going to become a meteorologist, you think?
I'm thinking about being a doctor instead.
I'm heading toward the marine sciences area, which will have a lot to do with weather, obviously, so it's an important part of what I want to do.
And we didn't really get into too much of how the weather affects a lot of the habitat and the animals, but we know that the estuary is very dynamic, and that weather helps drive this dynamic environment we have out here, with the tides, the winds, the animals and the plants having to deal with the storms that occur, flooding, and you know, having 40 degree weather one day and 85 degree weather the next. Like I said, it's a very dynamic ecosystem out here. Weather's a really important part of it. We appreciate you spending time out here with us today. And does the Weather Service ever offer tours of your facilities? Or
yes, we do. Yeah, you can contact the Weather Service. It's 223, area code 252-223-5122. If you want to have a tour, and the person to ask for is John Cole, who is here today from the Weather Service. He's our warning coordination meteorologist, and he handles setting up tours and things like that. So call the Weather Service and ask for John Cole.
Well, I think that's it for the end of this session. We'll be back in another 5 minutes, I'm sorry, and we'll be talking about decoy carving. So, and what teachers, while you're out there, if you please send in your evaluations, we need that to help improve our Estuary Live event. We want to thank Hunter and Megan for participating out here with us today in what's been a changing weather condition, and we'll see you again in a few minutes. Thanks.